While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On The Reading News Analysis right here on Eagle FM, your number one talk radio station. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and today is Thursday, the 9th of April, 2026. Now, as the week gains momentum, the country is firmly back in motion. Across Namibia, from Windhoek to Walvis Bay, Oshakati to Ketmanshoop, the focus is clear: productivity, growth, and navigating the realities of an evolving economic and social landscape. Now, workplaces are fully operational, schools are in full swing, and businesses actively engaging with both opportunities and challenges, shaping the current climate. Now, this is the rhythm of a nation pushing forward, balancing immediate demands with long-term ambition. Now, on today's program, we shift our focus to the drivers behind Namibia's economic trajectory. What trends are emerging across the sector? How are businesses adapting to changing consumer behavior and market conditions? And what does this mean for growth, investment, and job creation in months ahead? We'll explore the broader national outlook, from policy direction and economic resilience to innovation and the expanding role of young Namibians in shaping the country's future. As industries evolve, so too must the strategies that support them. Now, as always, we remain grounded in the everyday realities that connect us all. How national decisions influence local experiences and how individual voices contribute to the bigger picture. We'll take a closer look at public accountability and service delivery, key pillars in maintaining trust and ensuring that development translates into real impact for communities across the country. Now, over the next 1 hour and 30 minutes, expect sharp analysis, meaningful conversations and insights that do matter. Whether you are at your desk, on the road, or tending in between commitments, this is your space. This right here is On The Radio News Analysis, not just reporting the news, but making sense of it. Oh, now yesterday, President Netumbo Ndaitwa delivered her second State of the Nation address, also known as SONA, a key constitutional obligation under Article 32, Clause 2. The address serves as an important part for updating Parliament and the nation on the country's current status, reviewing past policy implementation and outlining the government's priorities moving forward. It also includes a question and answer session, allowing for engagement with lawmakers in Parliament. Now, we do have a scheduled commercial break coming up. Let's pause for that. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Beat the fuel increase with USAID specials. 2 kilograms of real good frozen mixed chicken portions, a giveaway at $99.99 Namibian dollars. 2 kilograms of tastic rice, just $36.99 Namibian dollars. 500 grams of Romy 37% fat spread, just $13.99 Namibian dollars. 750 grams of U brand mayonnaise, just $34.99 Namibian dollars. Mind blowing savings up to the 19th of April 2026. Where, you ask? At USAID. I save, you save. We all save at USAID.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
Now, the SONA outlines the government is set to outline the government's priorities moving forward, and it also includes a question and answer session, allowing for engagement with lawmakers. Now, one of the questions that was posed by one of the lawmakers yesterday to President Netumbo Ndaitwa was in relation to disaster risk management, to which President Netumbo Ndaitwa responded that when we declare a national emergency, emergency, is that we also somehow indirectly attract or ask for help from outside countries and sort of like to depend on them for their assistance. And she responded to say that, and that's not what we want to do. We need to look within and sustain ourselves in terms, of course, of disaster risk, of state of emergency, declaring state of emergencies. And I think I couldn't agree with that statement even the more, which now sparks a debate or a question in regards to disaster risk management, which is what we will be tackling today. Now, disaster risk management is one of those topics that often sits in the background until something goes wrong. But in reality, it is a continuous proactive process that shapes how a country anticipates, prepares for, responds to, and recovers from disasters. At its core, disaster risk management is built on the idea of reducing vulnerability. Reducing vulnerability before a crisis even happens. Now it combines planning, infrastructure, policy, and community awareness to minimize the impact of hazards such as floods, droughts, fires, or disease outbreaks rather than reacting after the damage is done. Disaster risk management focuses on prevention, on mitigation, on preparedness, on response and recovery. A key concept within disaster risk management is risk assessment. Now, the process of identifying potential hazards, evaluating who or what is at risk, and determining how severe the impact could be, this is closely linked to early warning systems, which provide timely information that allows governments and communities to act before a hazard escalates into a disaster. Now, Namibia, disaster risk management is particularly important due to recurring challenges such as drought, floods in northern regions, and the increasingly unpredictability associated with climate change. Now, this hazard don't just affect the environment; they directly impact food security, water availability, infrastructure, and livelihoods. Now, the country has taken structured steps to address this risk through institutions like the Office of the Prime Minister, which oversees national disaster response and coordination. Policies and frameworks are in place, and there is growing emphasis on community-based preparedness, especially in high-risk regions. But the real question is, are we prepared? And the answer is mixed and worth examining honestly. Now, on the positive side, Namibia has improved in areas such as early warning dissemination, coordination between government agencies, and regional response planning. There is greater awareness today than a decade ago, and disaster response mechanisms are more organized. However, challenges remain. Limited resources, infrastructure gaps, and uneven preparedness at local levels can slow down effective response. In some communities, especially in rural areas, access to timely information and emergency support is still inconsistent. Urban areas too face emerging risk, including informal settlement fires and flood due to rapid urbanization. Now, another critical factor is public awareness. Disaster risk management is not only a government responsibility. It depends heavily on how well individuals and communities understand risks and respond to warnings. Preparedness at household level, such as knowing evacuation procedures or safety essential resources, can significantly reduce harm. Now, we're going to engage Sean Naude of Marshall Rangers to understand more and discuss in depth further whether Namibia is prepared for any disaster should it take place. Let's pause here shortly and get hold of him.
Lipura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo duto ingida ashike kapeno nwe odite opoye ekukurile oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi tayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijabo ili nawa ninge Pada fanona, Monica ko Eagle FM, onora itatuimwe bali heali, nola natu, heali bali no heali. Ileko derewa, bora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu batatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Welcome back. And of course, joining us in studio telephonically is Sean Naude of the... He is a much of from Marshall Rangers. Sheriff Marshall, Sheriff Sean, I think it's normal for people to call you Marshall as well, right? Sean, a very good afternoon. Yes. Welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
You know what? I'm actually just Sean. And then the titles are just earned through years and then respect through my unit.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I'm just the son of the soil, and I'm here to serve and protect my country.
Wonderful, man. Wonderful. Now, Sean, of course, let's get right into this very interesting topic that is still dear to my heart even till today. You being the head and founder of National Emergency Response Unit that deals with disaster risks. Now, let's understand whether we Namibians are ready for any eventuality in terms of disaster risk management. What's your take on that?
All right, yes. One of the reasons why we started NERO was because we saw when there were national crises of small proportions like flooding and fires and stuff, the government could not handle it on their own. I'm not saying they were incapable or whether they had the funds or resources, but they could not handle it on their own. So the private sector decided to stand together and work together with all these officials to be able to add extra support should they need us. And that is where NERO comes from, a national emergency response unit, because we are there to respond when there's an emergency with members all over the country. That is so that, and many of them are qualified medics, qualified firemen, experienced in the field. This is not just anybody who wants to volunteer. These are trained, certified, and experienced members of NERO.
Interesting. Now, in terms of disaster management, Sean, are we prepared in, I know I asked us the same question now, but I'm going much more in depth about it. Are we prepared as a nation? Of course, we have those who have the qualifications, such as now NERO, having to cater for that. But is the nation itself, well educated? Are we doing it perhaps enough in awareness? Are they able to take on challenges? Because when it comes to disaster management, for instance, and a community now needs help, yes, while we wait for response to come in, would you say our communities themselves are really well equipped, well knowledgeable on what to do when there is a flood, a fire, for instance?
The answer directly is no, not at all. We are not trained. We are not educated enough. We are not given enough demonstrations through our leaders. A nation should be able to do drills that if a flood happens, everybody knows what are the protocols, who's in control, who is in charge, where do you volunteer, where do you stand together, because only if you stand together you will be able to take care of it. But we have too little investment into such things from the government side, which are supposed to be our national defense. Should something happen, let's not even go to a war, because if a war breaks out, this country is going to be lost, because we are not standing strong enough and united enough to know what do we do should something like this happen. Every year with the flooding alone, we have people that die. We have people that get swept away by rivers. And there should be national protocols in place that should something like a natural disaster happen, that we are able to all, with the public's assistance, be able to avoid things like people being taken down rivers, because every entrance and exit to any form of river will be shut off immediately by officials. And that way we can protect our people and our nations. When big fires break out, there's a lot of people that run around trying to help, but there's no actual stability in it. There's no, what do we do? What protocols? Who do we call? Even in a drowning, you know, people don't even know who to call when somebody drowns at the coast. This is very, very important that the nation, number one, find out for themselves where they can get the emergency numbers. But the government and the leaders should be turning around and doing educational programs, drills, should something happen in an area which has floods, what do you do? A siren goes off. When the siren goes off, everybody knows, do this, do that, the next thing. We don't have those things in place. If disaster hits us, people are going to be running around like chickens without heads.
Yeah, actually, yes. I also want to ask to draw back to believe it was just last month when three teachers were involved in that car accident, heading towards Chuarongo, right? And I came across a certain video whereby, of course, the first person, or the, in the video, the first person wasn't, I don't know, perhaps they were the driver or so, was, you could kind of like tell that this person has passed on. But then the two at the back, there was one who was actually moving their head. And I was also questioning myself with the little knowledge that I have in terms of emergency. I asked the question to myself, did they even attempt to open this door, or people were just busy filming? How do we perhaps now, do we move people from this mindset of always being on the lookout to make headlines, to make news headlines, instead of actually being proactive and trying to help those who are involved in incidents such as this?
I'm 100% with you. I got that footage immediately when it was sent. I sent it to officials. This is why a strategic plan should also be in place, that when an accident happens, people know what to do, who may take control, who coordinates. I'm busy with the government at the moment to try and make it mandatory, at least, that when you do your learner's license, you need to also do a first aid course. Because, and things like putting fire extinguishers in every vehicle and not just passenger liners, very small things. If you can get a fine and not get a roadworthy certificate for a triangle that's not in your car, then a fire extinguisher should at least be, because five cars stopping with fire extinguishers could possibly put out a fire, you know what I mean, before it spreads, you see? So, and people knowing first aid would know how to stabilize, how to remove people, extract them, if it's safe to extract them, if there's flammable things like that, things burning, get them out of the vehicle as quick. It's called life over limb.
Exactly.
So you get them out. If there's no direct threat, leave them in the car. But first aid will teach you all these things. We could save so many lives. Do you know how long it takes you to bleed out? Less than 2 minutes.
Mm.
Then you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a profuse bleeding on your arm, so you're going to die just because somebody didn't take the effort to put a tourniquet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just cut off the circulation for that moment so that you can get, your body can take care of itself. And those things can save lives. So I think at the end of the day, this is a very big thing that needs to be addressed, and why we have our NAMSTRONG platforms, which are started 16 years ago to unite the nation, officials and public, so that they can work together. Any accidents, any incidents, everything just reported. What do? I'm standing on a scene. We have medics on call. We have a helpline, a 919 toll-free number. You can call and say, I've just come upon an accident. You need to learn like the MVA fund's telephone number. These things can help save lives. But at the end of the day, people are, instead of phoning, they're pulling out their phones and taking videos.
Pause for me quickly.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no, why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the Mimi with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily, with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
The views and opinions
Sean, sorry about that.
Callers and
that's okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You were busy making a very critical point to say, instead of actually offering.
Are we back?
We're back.
I was just listening to Edward. Okay. So I just wanted to get to the most vital part of this is, instead of climbing out your vehicles and taking videos, can you please make sure that the emergency services get notified and that somebody is actually attending? Give vital information. How many vehicles are involved? Are there passengers? Are there entrapments? Is there anything leaking? Is there a fire? Those things make a difference, because delays things for like fire department only gets dispatched if there is entrapments or a fire. But if there isn't, then it's just a normal accident. But if the ambulance gets there and he sees there's entrapments, now we have to wait for a fire truck. So if people can at least do their part, instead of taking videos for sensation and insensitive videos, I've seen the worst of the worst. I mean, I've been on so many scenes in my life. And even when I took footage for our NAMSTRANG strong platforms, we have strict rules. You don't put identification. You do not put bodies. You do not put injured persons. You just don't put that on social media. It's wrong.
Yeah.
It's immoral. It's just wrong. Don't do it. You put it on my platforms, my admin will kick you off. It doesn't work that way. That's somebody's child, somebody's daughter. Nobody wants to see their child struggling in a car while six people are walking around the car taking videos before a fire even started, okay? And instead of trying to break open the door and get that person out, even because they are still, they were definitely alive when that video was taken. And to, for me to be sitting here knowing that somebody burnt in a vehicle that was still alive, okay, because people rather take videos. That is wrong. I'm saying right, all man saying to the nation, it's wrong. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Don't put such, even if you see it on other platforms in YouTube, it's wrong. It's like, you know, when somebody drowns here, that's somebody's child. You might not care, but that's somebody's child.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And we need to become humane again.
True.
We really, everything's about social media likes and comments and stuff like that. I promise you, the last thing I seek in my life is sensation. I was there. My thing is to bring a nation to stand together so that we can work together and make this place better and safer for us. We're just over 3 million Namibians. That's like a residential area in South Africa, you know? Let's stand together. We can make have the most powerful country in this in Africa.
Correct. Now, in terms of also now standing up for ourselves, the, like by that I mean officials who are qualified, obviously coming together, whether it's private sectors or government sectors coming together to work together to prepare in terms of prepare for disasters that may happen and will eventually happen. I mean, we're talking about climate change. We're talking about, so they will definitely happen. So we need to prepare. Would you say we get together to really prepare in advance for such eventualities before they do happen? I mean, so we see our neighboring countries now facing floods, and no, they're not prepared. When we actually read their news, they're not prepared. They were not prepared.
Yeah, the national the natural disasters is something that happens annually. We should already be ready and prepared before. Oh, it's going to be winter now. We've got long grass. We had good rains. Okay, let's start making fire lines, fire breaks, instead of thousands of hectares burning before people go, ooh, we didn't know the fire was coming. We know every year. We know this time of the year we have fires. We know this time of the year we have floods. But we don't prepare. We stall because we don't care until it hits us. You know, that's the thing about humans. We don't care what happens to the neighbor until it happens to us. So this is what's happening right now, is the fact that we need to know. We need to understand. We need to know. And when natural disasters or anything happens, it is time that the government recognize people like the Namibian Marshall Rangers, who've served the country for 12 years as a private law enforcement and emergency rescue services, to acknowledge people like our institutions like NERO, Neighborhood Watch, Community Services and stuff, and make sure that when everybody sits around one table, okay, there's an understanding that when this disaster happens, these people are in charge, and you all fall under, and whatever you contribute, vehicles, firefighters, you name it, gets coordinated by one central coordination. But we find many times on fires that there are five or six coordinators and two or three groups, and one is pushing the fire to that side and the other one's making a what they call a voorbrand, you know what I mean? And so one's putting out a fire, the other one's starting a fire. And here we're sitting with a big problem. So if we don't sit down, and it's the government's duty as the head of the table, because when we take it to a table, they will be the head of the table because we fall under government. There's a lot of respect for them, but if they're not going to do their jobs, we will, as a people, as a nation, we will do it. We're not going to be dependent on the government. We are going to depend on ourselves as people, whether you work for the government or not. I've got people that are official police officers, everything, but when it comes down to the crunch, they are Nero. They are a human being that is a patriot of their country, and they're going to fall in. They're not going to regard anymore. It's going to be disaster management, and it's like war. In the rules of war is different to civil law, you know? So, yes, we got to sit all together, and we got to talk, and not just talk. We got to take action, because there's a lot of talking going on, but very little action. It's only when the public complain that action gets taken, and it shouldn't be that way.
Sure.
So, I agree. We should all sit around one table and work this out. And everybody must put their egos aside and their personal issues aside, and they must look at a bigger picture, because we have a problem in Namibia where everybody wants to be a general. And everybody wants to be in control. It doesn't work that way. You're never going to settle. Everybody must be a humble servant walking into that room. No less, no more than the other.
True. I agree with you. Sean, thank you so much.
I hope this clarifies some things. And you know what? Hey, let's be wise. Let's save lives, and let's learn to work together. And we have a helpline, 919. It's toll-free. I sit personally with the emergency phone in my hand to make sure that every single situation gets attended and handled.
You know what? You did say that Nero has trained qualified people all over the country. I would really want to see more young people, even perhaps those who have finished university and are waiting employment, not because they desire to be in the emergency sector, but maybe just as a precaution, as being that person. As much as you are an accountant, you are also able to offer help should that help be needed. So yeah, let me also look forward to seeing a lot of young people being trained by the Marshall Rangers and by Nero itself to also be able to give those first aid.
We would love to offer these services. This is one of our goals. We even started a community patient and rescue trust foundation. It's CPR Foundation. You can find us on social media. The only thing we lack is financial and equipment and stuff like that. And then we can train up every citizen and give them classes and give them so that, because you know it's like you cannot give a person a gun without the knowledge of knowing how to handle a gun and to be responsible. So when war comes, you can't suddenly stick guns in the hands of civilians and expect them to fight your battle for you. So if you want to use us as a government to help and support you, then you give us the knowledge and the education. It should come from the government side, but we as Nero are willing to work side by side and offer this. And we do need support. But I'm not on here asking for anything. I do what I do because we have a passion to bring this to the country.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you so much for making time for us right here.
I love it. And I love speaking to you. Happy, always a pleasure. And everybody there, thank you very much. And let's be wise and save lives.
Sure. Thank you, Sean. Bye. Of course, there we had it from Sean Naude. He is from the Marshall Rangers, a sheriff from the Marshall Rangers. Of course, now we get hold of a disaster risk management specialist from the city of Windhoek. Let's also find out from him what actually disaster risk management is like for them, and how do they handle it? How does the city of Windhoek come into aid when it comes to disaster risk management?
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers.
And of course, we are back. Joining us in studio now telephonically is Mr. Ngolombe Paulus, and he is a disaster risk reduction specialist operating right from City of Windhoek. A very good afternoon to you, sir, and welcome to On the Radar.
Yes, good afternoon. Happy. It's good to be back.
Yeah, pleasure is all mine. I'm not so sure if you are aware. This is one of my very favorite topics to discuss about because I myself had it as a module, disaster risk management. But I love your title, disaster risk reduction specialist. That would be reduction. But let's get and hear from you what disaster risk management is and whether Namibia is actually prepared should any eventuality happens.
Thank you very much, Happy. In brief, disaster risk reduction basically is to do with a hazard because it is hazards that causes disaster. And maybe for easier explanation is when I give an example. Mm-hmm. When you have got flooding is a hazard. Because when it floods and it gets to cause some damages, then that is what we'll have as a disaster. So that means that it's flooding and it's damaging maybe people's mango fields or crops, or it's killing animals and it's damaging to houses, and then that becomes a disaster. Mm-hmm. That's how I can explain it in short. So disaster risk reduction, therefore, is to reduce the risk of disaster.
Yeah.
Or to reduce the impact of disaster.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what you deal with almost sort of to say on a daily basis, disaster risk reduction.
You are right. That is what I've been dealing with for, what made me a specialist is this I've been dealing with for now close to 25 years.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And now the most important question comes in to say, are we prepared to handle disasters when they do happen? Because, I mean, every year we sort of see disasters happening, whether it's flood, whether it's fire. Are we prepared as Namibia? And by preparation, I'm asking in terms of whether private sectors or government agencies coming together to collectively at the same time try and reduce the risks that come with those disasters.
Yes, generally speaking, we are the country as a country. We are prepared. I think we are more than prepared to actually deal with disasters. And the reason for me saying we are prepared generally is because we have a framework, which is a legal framework. We have people in terms of staffing that are on a daily basis devoted to deal with disasters. So generally we are prepared. But specifically, one can never be prepared because disasters, natural disasters are such that one can never be prepared for them. Rainfall, for example, drought, for example, you can never be prepared because it's nature taking its course. However, in terms of legal framework, in terms of having people, yes, we are prepared. I can say we are prepared. Even logistically speaking, in terms of material, yes, we are prepared. There is a legal framework. There is a budget in terms of financial provision. And then there are different institutions that are actually dealing with these things on a daily basis.
Interesting. Now, of course, dealing with that your office that you're dealing with disaster risk reduction, is it also working in, together with other stakeholders, such as, of course, the Office of the Prime Minister? And while we are at that question, somebody posed a question to President Netumbona Nditaitwa yesterday after her State of the Nation address in terms of declaring a national disaster, something like that. And she said, she responded to say, when you do that, you sort of also invite outsiders, people from outsiders, other countries to come and assist us. But then again, we need to look within ourselves in terms of sustainability and having to deal with our own. What do you think also, what is your take in that regard?
I think I agree with the president when she said that is basically declaring yourself vulnerable or incapable.
Exactly.
I actually agree with her. Apart from just you as a country making your country look bad, when you look into specific things, I think we are looking into a disaster that has affected only one region. Right? Yeah. Heavily, when we are talking about affected, the region that is affected is only one region that is affected heavily. And when you look at that and you look at for the rest of the 13 region, basically have people, resources in terms of financial, in terms of people, in terms of transport that can basically be deployed to go assist. And we have not yet exhausted that, those resources. So to be able to, for you as a country to call outside while you have not yet exhausted your resources within a country, it will not make any sense. And therefore, the president is 100% right. In addition to that, remember when you declare disaster, basically you are saying, I can't handle it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, we are not even in a month yet into this whole thing. So for us to just... rush and said, no, if a disaster, we need help. I don't think that makes sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think even the region itself has really failed to handle it. It's a matter of, it's a natural phenomenon that has taken place. Yes, we're prepared, but it takes time for the country to reorganize itself and actually arrest the situation.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so the president has a point in terms of saying, no, we have not yet exhausted all our resources, so we cannot just go and call for external help.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say we don't need, it's just that we have enough resources. I mean, I myself had to work all over the country, so it has not even come to me yet to know that my expertise are needed yet. So you can already tell, and there's quite a number of us like me who has
mm-hmm.
both experience in terms of practical experience has worked with these things over a period of time. So I think the president has a point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, Mr. Paulus, what is that you would want to inform the nation or the public, myself and, of course, the rest of the public out there, in terms of responding to disasters, to hazards, to fire, to, you know, all the different hazards? What is it that we should be first cautious of, maybe also in terms of awareness? Because I tend to notice that, of course, it's not everybody that gets the understanding or even has the basic knowledge of what to do immediately in terms of hazards.
What you should be aware of, I could probably mention about three things.
Okay.
The first one is that we should be able to be aware that Namibia as a country has really three main disasters that we've been fighting, let me say, since independence. It's basically drought, it's floods, and diseases are outbreak. All right. Now, that itself, we should therefore, when you speak about awareness, you should be able to be aware of that specifically. So when we have drought, we know it's likely to affect half of the country or a portion of the country. Already, individually, therefore, we should already have that awareness that what if I'm from Hangwena region, I'm from Commerce, I should be able to be honest with myself and say I should be prepared for floods. I should be prepared for disaster. You understand? As an individual now.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. The second one is that the people should start to respect the information we are giving to them on a daily basis, on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
Because just because it's calm, it doesn't mean that calamity will not strike any other time. You know, I mean calamity, I mean disaster.
Yeah.
So it is maybe high time that we are taken very seriously. I mean, to give you a good example, the weathermen have been saying we are expecting normal to above normal rainfalls.
Mm.
And when you are hearing that, you could already tell that flood is likely to take place. So therefore, you must already start to prepare yourself as an individual, as a family, as a constituency, as a region, because the nationally, the weatherman is already talking to you about it. And basically, the weatherman is the only person that gives us those notices in terms of either we are going to have drought or we are going to have floods.
Yeah.
We should therefore be aware and then take precautionary measures as we continuously are informed. The third one is then the community. The community basically make themselves vulnerable by settling into vulnerable areas.
Mm.
Overcrowding is dangerous because when we have a disease outbreak, it's easy for it to spread because we are overcrowded. I can, especially diseases that has to do with conduct or that are airborne and so on.
Yeah.
So when we are told that we must decongest, we must build according to specific standards, it's because we are informing them that in case we are going to have a disaster, it will be very difficult for the community to cope with it. So it is just high time that we should take really these things very seriously. And basically, the law is very clear. The institution that the government has set up already, when I talk about the institution here, which is now my third point, is that the institution that exists right now, maybe it's high time they become more active. And I'm talking about constituency disaster risk management committees, region, local disaster risk management committee, regional disaster risk management committee, and the national disaster risk management committee, because oftentimes these committees only become active when we have already an outbreak of a disease, when we already have a disaster. And I think it's high time that these things are really taken seriously, and we on a daily basis that what I would like to call the disaster risk management gospel should be taken really seriously. It's like maybe the second part of us going to church, like going to church on Sunday, which is once a week. So maybe it's high time that we also maybe once a week we really take time to devote our time to deal with the issue of the disaster risk reduction, because that will lessen the impact.
Indeed, creating awareness, public awareness.
Yeah.
I think that's something that should definitely be put on the card.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that for me matters a lot in terms of and maybe what is important is that you might be aware that indigenous knowledge, it's something that inherent with us, and that's earlier when I said you should be aware of what the likely disaster your region is supposed to face, goes with indigenous knowledge. We already know in Namibia where we are likely to have foot and mouth disease or anthrax.
Yeah.
We already know. So therefore, why should we wait until it's too late? We already know that if we are going to have heavy rain around Angola DRC, the Zambezi River is going to break its banks.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be flooding, and that's a disaster to us. Mm-hmm. So indigenously, we already know. So why should we wait until we are in the water for us to take action? It shouldn't be like that.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be prepared, and being prepared is to be able to say, no, okay, I must move to highland already when the weatherman is telling me there's abnormal rain. Because the government has already made provision for you to be given these tents for temporary housing, for temporary schools, and so on. So every time when we have to ferry people from a disaster-affected area, it also becomes costly and so on, and sometimes it's not good because the resources could be devoted elsewhere for the development of the country.
Indeed, correct.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting, but I'm with you on the point of awareness every now and then that this message should be reiterated, or actually for some, they would even be hearing it for the first time, but it would make so much impact and so much difference. I mean, hence the saying, prevention is better than cure.
Yeah, that's correct. And specifically at the city of Windhoek, I'm actually heading a section that is responsible for public information and awareness creation.
Mm-hmm.
From the city side, we really have an we are active. We are informing, and like I said before, there's always these pockets of for a lack of a better word, there's a pockets of ignorance.
Mm.
Yeah, from the people. Remember, I think about 15 years ago, or so. Somebody basically just informed us outright that, no, I've been here for 50 years. I've never experienced flood before, so I'm not moving.
Yeah.
And the next night, the whole house was flooded. So there are some of those ignorance pockets among our communities.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we must stop creating awareness, because that is what we are supposed to do. Because, mind you, there are other factors as well.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe another discussion one day is where I would really want us to zoom into the issue of land delivery.
Mm.
Yes.
Land delivery. Okay.
Because settlement, when you look at settlement, now here I'm whether it is fire, mm-hmm. whether it's flooding, whether it's a disease outbreak, the land in terms of settlement, where people are living, how people are living, has a role to play, because planning then becomes easier. And for us, because we are structured in terms of how we want things to be in terms of preparedness, and here I can give you an example of the issue at the coast where a number of houses were all gutted by the fire.
Yeah.
That's a building standard, it's a building regulation. So for us to be able to create awareness, certain things need to be in place. And that really borders in the issues of land delivery or land availability or the way people have settled. And like I said, it's a discussion for another day.
Most definitely, we will get into it.
Yeah, it's something that I would want to zoom in, because even some community like now in Zambezi would be able to tell you that I have got no way to go. I mean, this is my ancestral land, so for me to be able to move here for about 20 kilometers, that's basically where other people are living. So there are quite a number of underlying issues as well.
Okay.
So in your process of, because in the process, remember, in the process of you creating awareness, you're also collecting information, isn't it? And you are documenting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in the process of documenting your feedback, you get to be told the challenges that are faced. Likely, even if people should basically do what you are asking them to do, there are challenges and limitations as to what they can do.
I hear you. But we will definitely get into that. Thank you so much, Mr. Angolombe Paulus. I really do appreciate you making time for us right here on the radar.
You are welcome. I'm available anytime.
Okay.
Anywhere.
Okay. All right. Wonderful.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
And then we had it from Mr. Ngolombe Paulus, disaster risk reduction specialist at the city of Windhoek. Of course, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly after that.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you. With us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the R.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its
Eagle staff. FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida.
Welcome back, and now let's get into news beyond the borders of Namibia. Let's start off in South Africa. As SANRAL invests billions to rehabilitate roads in Mpumalanga.
The R40 road, a key route, sustained severe damage in the recent floods following continuous rain. On this stretch between White River and Hazyview, over 40 million rand was spent to reconstruct the bridge. But 2 months after the completion, it was flagged as a no-go area over safety concerns due to a major crack in the surface.
Here on the R40, we've got 5 sites where there has been slippage. It doesn't all look the same, but it's essentially the same problem. And of those 5 sites, 3 are currently active, meaning we are busy working on repairing them. 2 are in the procurement stage. Altogether on the R40, we're spending 120 million. The engineers are advising me that we have to change the design on this particular rehabilitation, and we have to build it up with stones and concrete, and that it won't be enough just to have vegetation, which was the initial plan.
The R40 road carries hundreds of cargo loads daily, with much of it transported from Palabora mines to Mozambique. Chrissy says plans are underway to move some of the cargo from the road to rail, and over 3.7 billion has been allocated for the coal line to be rehabilitated.
Most of the movement on these roads is coal, and that is major rehabilitation of that line so that we can increase the number of trains that we are running, and we can increase the numbers of million tons of cargo that we are carrying. Yesterday, I had a meeting with my counterpart from Mozambique, and what we've agreed with him is that during May, he will come to South Africa, and he will bring his rail company, and we will facilitate a meeting between his rail entity and Transnet. And the purpose of that meeting is to discuss whether we can do a joint rehabilitation of the railway line that goes to Maputo. Because what you would understand is most of the trucks that are traveling on these roads are actually going through the Lubombo border post bound for Maputo.
The minister also announced that mining companies have pledged to inject millions of rands to assist with the rehabilitation of some of the roads. Nhlamulo Mabasa, SABC News, White River.
Meanwhile, data breach at major bank, Anthony Boucher says, shares more.
One of Africa's biggest banks by assets has informed its business clients
of a data breach that exposed their personal information. The announcement came a month after their subsidiary also suffered a data breach. This attack comes at a time South African organizations are increasingly getting targeted by cyber criminals. According to Checkpoint Research, South African organizations faced an average of 2,145 cyber attacks per week, a 36% increase year on year. The global average was 2,090. For more on this, we're joined by cybersecurity expert Anthony Boucher from the Mike Bullhays Specialized Security Services. Anthony, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. My goodness, 2,145 attacks per week on average is a staggering number in a single country. What do we know what the bulk of cybersecurity attacks are and which of those typically do succeed?
Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity. So these attacks, yes, it's quite a lot, over 2,000 per week. I mean, since this incident has been reported, we've probably seen another 4,000 attacks already. And major financial institutions are being targeted, so we do see that quite a lot. They are targeting credential information, and that's mainly to meet the objective of doing targeted attacks on consumers. I mean, if you have someone's personal information, you have their credentials, you have account information and such, when you do target them through phishing attacks, vishing attacks and such, it is more targeted and it is more successful. I mean, you can think for yourself, if you are called by someone posing to be from the bank and they have your credentials, they have all of your information and they can actually repeat your account number, your ID number and things like that to you, it is much more likely to be a successful attack. And that is why they do target credentials when they do perform these attacks.
My next question was going to be, what good is the information that the hackers obtained from the Standard Bank breach? Because Standard Bank put out a statement and said, look, all transactional data as well as the money of clients are safe. That has not been breached. That has not been touched. What has been found is the names, ID numbers, and company registration numbers of business banking clients there. And you say in the hands of a conniving hacker, that information is sufficient to be able to successfully launch phishing attacks?
Most definitely, it is more than sufficient. I mean, we see a massive incline and increase in phishing attacks. We see people suffering major financial losses through phishing attacks, and the more targeted they are, the much more success you'll have with them. So the hackers do target credentials for that reason. Unfortunately, it is one of those things that has been on the increase and on the incline. And I mean, unless consumers are properly educated, which we can commend the bank for reporting this and for following the correct procedure and alerting their clients to the possibility of attacks coming. That's excellent from the playbook, I would say. But consumers do need to be educated, and they do need to realize that these attacks are on the increase, and it's something that it's targeted. I mean, small information like an ID number or an account number in the hands of a proper social engineering hacker or scammer can be extremely lethal.
Yeah. Why is biographical information and data so easily hackable and accessible? We saw this in a number of hacks. And here I'm talking about things like accessing the names, ID numbers, potentially addresses, cell phone numbers, and in this instance, company registration numbers as well. How exposed are these databases?
They are not really that exposed. I mean, you do have to consider who you are dealing with. I mean, we are not talking about your average living room hacker. Yeah, you are talking about organized crime syndicates who do, I mean, they do this as a profession, basically. I mean, it's what they do, it's what they focus on, and breaching systems is what they live for. So obviously, security is a layered-based approach in cybersecurity. So obviously, you're not talking about an employee sharing a password, yeah, and then someone's money can be moved. But, I mean, your databases are layered, and you do get instances where specific data is a bit more susceptible to hacking and to breach than other data would be. In this case, I do think that the bank caught it early enough to basically manage the risk and manage the exposure. And once again, as I said, I can only commend the bank for the way that they've approached this and the way that they've dealt with it.
How could the bank have potentially prevented this? What is known about the modus operandi that made this attempt so successful?
Well, no system is completely impenetrable. I mean, there's no such thing. That's the reason we see over 2,000 attacks per week in South Africa. No system cannot be breached. No software cannot be accessed maliciously. So, I mean, you can basically do what you do. And I mean, the banks and other institutions have teams of cybersecurity experts scanning for breaches on a daily basis. And that's why you see so many upgrades and you see so many updates on software.
Oh, my goodness. I think we've lost Anthony there. Yeah, just in the middle of quite an important response there. Anthony Boucher is a cybersecurity expert.
Meanwhile, Gauteng investment gets underway.
It's a flagship provincial platform aimed at mobilizing investment, advancing industrialization, and accelerating inclusive economic growth. The conference has shifted its focus from merely collecting pledges to the actual implementation of projects. Financial goal? Well, it seeks to secure 200 billion rand in new investment commitments. SABC News reporter Diabo Seto has more on this story for us. Diabo, good morning to you.
Good morning, Leanne. I was just looking at my clock now. It's actually 14 minutes and 37 seconds to go before the Gauteng Investment Conference officially kicks off. And the Deputy President, I understand, is making his way to the venue as we speak now. You spoke about some interesting numbers. Just to remind our viewers, Leanne, that the target of the Gauteng province in terms of investment over 5 years is that they want to collect about 800 billion in investment. So far, they've collected about 312. This is last year's one, 312.5 billion. I see here the number of projects that have been completed or implemented is 18, with a project value of just under 82 billion rands. And this time around, they're hoping to attract about 200 billion worth of investments. And I see that with the previous conference and pledges, mostly it was projects around the property sector that seemed to have gained more momentum. I've asked Mr. Muzim Matema, who is also the chief economist at the Gauteng agency, to come and join us so that he can give us the overview for today about how they plan to mobilize and make sure that this 200 billion is really indeed gotten and how it will be implemented or how it will be used to be able to benefit the people of Gauteng. Mr. Matema, appreciate your time and welcome to SABC News. I've just been telling Leanne about where we are right now. With this 200 billion that you are hoping and targeting, how is this going to affect the people of Gauteng as well as service delivery, and which sectors will you be targeting right now?
Thank you so much and good morning to your viewers. So just to be clear, the 200 billion, we've been working the past 12 months to achieve it. So we're very confident that when we announce today, we will achieve a figure in excess of that amount. However, what is important is the reason why we have these investment conferences is we are strongly convinced that capital in the Gauteng city region will result in jobs created, factories built, goods exported from Gauteng, and overall people's lives changed through economic development.
Yeah. With everything that's happening globally, how do you see investment honestly being sorted out with regards to everything that is happening? I understand that the Deputy President has just walked in. If you could just answer this question very quickly, then I'll let you go.
Okay.
The global events, how they impact what you're trying to achieve in terms of attracting investment?
The global events give us an opportunity to geopolitically be very strategic. Gauteng, like most strategic destinations in the world, is a very open investment destination. We attract capital from all over the world, so we are quite confident that the current geopolitical changes that you talk about allow us to assess those dynamics to see where capital will come from. Unfortunately, I have to leave. due to prison.
To completely understand the Deputy President is here, Leanne. Mr. Matema has to leave us while we are busy with that interview, but he's given us the nap of what they are planning to do as the Gauteng province. Of course, it comes here hot on the heels of the South Africa Investment Conference that we saw last week, and we'll hear from the Deputy President, and hopefully we'll also get to hear his thoughts about what's been happening globally and how that will impact what the Gauteng province aims to do within terms of investment. As I said, the target for this time around that they've been working towards in the past 12 months is 200 billion. The total investment is over 5 years of 800 billion. So far, 312 and a half billion grand, 18 projects completed of the value of about just under 82 billion grand. And we're going to kind of go inside and set up to make sure that we don't miss the Deputy President as he makes his keynote address. And oh, by the way, we also have a new MEC of Finance coming from the EFF, Mr. Nkululeko Dunga, and we'll want to hear what he has to say and how the handover is done between himself and MEC Mailo, who's the former MEC for Finance and whom this investment conference has been his brainchild. So we'll find out, you know, how the handover works out. I understand that both MECs are on the program, so we most likely are going to hear from both of them and to see how this project progresses under a new set of hands. Leanne.
All right. As you can see, we're in good hands covering this investment conference, and that's Diabo Seto. So thank you so much for giving us all of that information from the Gauteng Investment Conference.
African women dominate the health workforce, but apparently lag in leadership.
Recent statistics indicate that women make up approximately 70% of workers in the health and social welfare sectors globally. But despite these high numbers, women remain underrepresented in senior leadership positions in the medical field. In Kenya, women doctors hold 40% of top-level leadership positions and 42% of mid-level roles in the national health sector. In Nigeria, about 33% of leadership roles in health organizations are held by women, but only one out of 28 directors of the federal medical centers is a woman. In South Africa, only 6 out of 26 higher education institutions, which train doctors and lead medical researchers, were led by women by 2022. CGTN's Beryl Roro talked to one of the women. Let's take a look.
Globally, women make up just 25% of all leadership roles in the healthcare sector.
At the beginning of the entry level, a lot of women are getting into STEM careers, into research, into science careers. So if I can look at it right now, medical graduates, about 50% of them are women. However, the more they progress, then the more we see this narrowing. It's as though the system somehow narrows and now starts filtering them out.
This reality exposes the need for intentional support to empower women to navigate the nuances of life as they participate effectively in the workplace.
So when I look at it myself, I was very hungry for female mentors who have been through the system, who have been mothers, who have been able to, you know, have motherhood, have family, and still progress. And I had very strong female mentors who were able to pour into me and to show me that, you know, there's nothing like a work-life balance. It's just giving priority to what matters at the time, but it is very possible.
After securing a seed grant from the World Health Organization for a mentorship initiative, Dr. Kanyari Mwendia now helps early career clinical researchers make inroads in this specialized field.
So when I moved into the clinical research space, I realized that I can't do this on my own. There are things that we are implementing in the studies that I need someone else's expertise. You have to work consultatively. So in this journey, I've been able to consult a lot, you know, collaborate a lot with my colleagues and see what works, what doesn't work. So it has not been a solo journey.
In addition to advocating for women in clinical research, Dr. Mwendia seeks to advocate for more of innovations and trials to be done in Africa.
When I started working in clinical research, I started to see the bottlenecks that exist. One, when it comes to the access to innovation that, you know, we as Africans have. So of all the global clinical trials done worldwide, only 4% are done in Africa. Mm-hmm. So this is a very small number. And you know that the African genome is one of the, you know, most diverse genomes.
Therefore, there is a great need to have the innovations that we are putting out more centered around the people and the access, I mean, the people that it will be working on.
This year's theme for the World Health Day is Together for Health, Stand with Science, highlighting how professionals in science in Africa can rally support for the continent.
So starting from government, calling government to have more funding when it comes to R&D, for private sector to come together to do more work on the continent that is for the benefit of the population. When it comes to the global health organizations, to be able to have more long-term plans that, you know, have more of the health of the health of Africans in mind.
Beryl Oro, CGTN.
Meanwhile, markets update. Oil prices rise on US-Iran truce doubts.
Iran lifted investor sentiment. All three major US stock indexes surged at the opening bell. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 2.85%, the S&P 500 2.51%, and the Nasdaq Composite gained 2.80%. Let's take a look at the indicators. Local markets losing ground today as fragile US-Iran truce keeps investors wary. On the JSE, the all-share index down 1% at 118,277. The rand giving up its gains, trading at 16 rand 46 to the dollar, 22.07 against the pound, 19.23 to the pound. Now, gold's at $4,727 an ounce, platinum at $2,039 an ounce, with Brent crude oil at $98.15 per barrel. Right, let's get some analysis on the markets. I'm now joined by Zwelakhe Mnguni from Benguela Global Fund Managers. A very good afternoon to you, Zwelakhe. Thank you so much for your time. As we take stock of oil prices climbing again after optimism around the ceasefire faded, because just yesterday markets seemed relieved somewhat when the ceasefire was announced. What exactly changed in the market sentiment today?
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I think the main thing is that it looks like the ceasefire has been broken again. We saw Israel hitting Lebanon, and there is an expectation that Iran retaliate, and therefore we are back to where we were a few days ago. So certainly the markets are nervous about that, because we've seen the impact of a closed Strait of Hormuz on global oil markets and also the global economy.
So with the volatility returning, as you say, are investors starting to price in the possibility that this conflict is far from over, as opposed to that wait-and-see approach that was what really was, you know, at the center of what could unfold?
Yeah, certainly. I think the market is pricing that in. I think you can see it in the oil price. It's inching closer to $100 again. And I think the market is certainly concerned that if Iran responds, the U.S. will retaliate. Therefore, we're back at where we were before. Mm. So the market is actually taking a lot of caution at this stage.
And with the oil rising and equities looking slightly nervous, how far do you suppose, in terms of implications, could the Hormuz tensions be felt? I mean, you know, looking into fertilizers, chemicals, industrial metals, could this translate now into even higher food prices globally?
Certainly. I think you need natural gas to produce urea and ammonia for the fertilizer market. And we know that the Qatari LNG plant has been damaged. And that alone is enough to actually increase prices in fertilizers. And therefore, higher prices in fertilizers mean that we would have higher food costs down the line. So it is certainly a major factor. It will also affect other areas of the market. I mean, the refineries would also struggle to make decent profits in the interim. But most importantly, the global economy becomes a lot more challenged in terms of growth, because a lot of the money will go to the gasoline or fuel costs, and that therefore consumption would slow down, and your ability to extract more taxes from consumption would actually slow down as well.
And in terms of impact, I mean, how soon could consumers start feeling this? I mean, we've already had, you know, escalating fuel price hikes here in South Africa. But, you know, what would this mean at the fuel pump, with the food basket, with transport costs, just watching at how these negotiations are going?
I think we've already had a step change in the fuel price. And in fact, if we remain below 100, we'd have expected that there'll be a slight improvement in the oil price. But I think we are likely to see everything staying more or less in terms of the fuel price, staying more or less where we are. I think where the challenge is going to be is that the secondary effects are going to filter into the economy now. So your food, your grocery costs are going to be increased because the transportation costs have increased. And it will be more or less within the next month or two, we'll start seeing the secondary effects coming through into the economy. And that's how you build inflation into the economy. And that means that you might actually face some challenges in terms of the ability to bring interest rates down further as we were on that trajectory.
As we talk about, you know, the negative element of it all, which sectors would typically benefit when oil rises, and which ones should investors perhaps be more worried about?
I'd be more favorable, I mean, to the oil and gas, you know, companies that, for example, if you look at the coal miners in South Africa, they benefited immensely from this challenge. But I would also be looking at in the offshore market, that look at the oil producers. I mean, Sasol has benefited. I think Sasol has gone up 100% in the last 2-3 months. And then I would say, you know, on the downside, I mean, I'd be cautious about anything that uses energy. So transportation sectors, your auto industries might face some challenges in that regard. In terms of the selling of vehicles, because the cost of vehicles would increase as well. So I would be more in favor of, I mean, if I'm an investor, I'd be more focused on the staples, because they'll get the pricing power back. So your food retailers would get the pricing power back, and that would enable them to be able to perform even during a bad time like this.
Yeah, very well. Thank you so much for speaking to us and that analysis. Relake Mguni from Benguela Global Fund Managers there, giving us a sense of the fluctuations and the volatility when it comes to the Strait of Hormuz and that impact on oil. But, you know, some glimmer of hope there that we're likely to more or less see the fuel price staying the same, but the effects could be felt in the next month or two when it comes to food and the food basket because of the transport costs. So a balanced look there at the bigger impact on the Strait of Hormuz in the markets.
And with that being said, we have now come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program, brought to you by Luise Shimi from Indafa. Happy Juju. It is goodbye, and I'll see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place. Don't forget the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 16:30 and the Business Economic Segment Show with David Shombe from 1800 hours. Goodbye.